Many decades ago, I became involved with PSYCOP, the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, and later would help setting up the Australian branch with the more simple title of Australian Skeptics. But I'm not going to let that lifelong scepticism in any way interfere with the next story, because it is just so bloody fascinating. The idea of communicating with the dead has been a part of many cultures across the globe, but modern spiritualism was taken up enthusiastically from the last half of the 19th century. And yes, the role of the spirit medium was usually a woman. Now, many of the mediums of the time plied their trade in the parlours of homes across all the classes, but even Queen Victoria was known to dabble in a bit of table turning. Now, what led to the rise of spiritualism at that time, and who were some of the women behind the upsurge? Emery Midorikawa attempts to answer these questions and more through the exploration of the lives of six women of the Victorian era who gained notoriety in their lifetime for their abilities to chat with the departed. They took their talents out of the parlour and onto the public stage, an opportunity to push forward progressive issues of the era, like the abolition of slavery, suffrage, equal rights for women. You might have thought that in the era of P.T. Barnum, they could have been simply opportunists making a buck from a gullible audience, but Emily will explain all as she introduces you to the wonderful true life characters in her book, Out of the Shadows, Six Visionary Victorian Women in Search of a Public Voice, published by Counterpoint. Emily, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
How did you find the stories of these women? Because you point out, although they were very famous in their time, their stories are, to say the least, not well known now.
Yes, well, I think as so often is the case with writers and researchers, it was research for a previous book that led me to these women. I was in the New York Public Library reading letters from Harriet Beecher Stowe, the 19th century author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, to George Eliot. And I was researching a completely different book at the time. It had nothing to do with spiritualism, nothing to do with spirits. And but reading these letters, I noticed that Harriet Beecher Stowe had mentioned a woman called Kate Fox on a number of occasions. And I realised as I read further into the letters that this Kate Fox was a spirit medium. Unlike yourself, Stowe was not a sceptic about spiritualism. She was she enjoyed attending seances. She believed in this sort of thing. George Eliot was a different category. She was much more sceptical. But I noticed that this woman, Kate Fox, kept cropping up in the letters. And two things struck me. One, that Kate Fox came across as a very she was a young American woman, and she came across as quite an otherworldly, almost sprite-like kind of presence in the letters. And the other thing that struck me was that Harriet Beecher Stowe seemed to assume that George Eliot, a British woman on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean from her, would know just who this Kate Fox was, which gave me a sense that she must have been very well known at the time. And that really piqued my interest, because I'd always thought of spirit mediums as, you know, conducting their business in small parlours, perhaps well known in a local community, but certainly not the sort of people who would be taking the international stage. So that really piqued my interest. And after I'd finished researching that book, I went back to these letters. And then from there, it opened up a whole world to me.
We've already done programmes on the huge upsurge of spiritualism during and after the First World War, for the obvious reasons that people were desperate to contact the people they'd lost. But this is before that time, isn't it? So why was there such a demand in the Victorian era for speaking to a dead relative?
Yes, so Kate Fox was one of three sisters, the Fox sisters, who became very well known during the era. And I think there was a few things that really led to their fame. Firstly, it was quite a novel thing to have these young little girls in the case of the two younger sisters and this group of women who are claiming to be able to contact the dead. But I think it was also, there was a few things that came along as a happy coincidence at the same time. One was, you know, the rise of the mass media, the rise also of fast communications between different parts of a country and even internationally, which meant that news about what these women were doing or supposedly doing could be spread quite quickly. I think it was also an era in which people were starting to really question ideas about religion, politics. You know, people were campaigning on issues such as in America, the abolition of slavery, all over the world, you know, extending the franchise to more men and also more women. So people were beginning to question the way that things were done, which I think also led into this. I think also it was a time when there was many, many scientific discoveries and technological advances that would have, you know, if you take something like the telegraph machine that could transport messages, you know, over great distances, only a few years earlier, this would have seemed completely impossible. So I suppose if people were seeing these wonders taking place in the real world, was it really that much of a stretch to think, okay, you know, we can send communications over vast distances within the world that we know. Perhaps we can also send messages between the realm of the living and the dead.
You discovered that Kate Fox had conducted a séance in the home of equal rights campaigner Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Now, this could be seen as coincidental, but perhaps there's a link between progressive thought and spiritualism. In fact, that's what your writing is about.
Yes, it was something that really interested me because I think one of the things that made the Fox sisters' reputation really grow was when they first became well known within their local community as, you know, people who could who would be around when the noises of spirit. Spirits were heard. That obviously created a great deal of fuss amongst the village that they lived in and the surrounding towns. But it was only really once their older sister, Leah, took the youngest two girls, Kate and Maggie, to the city of Rochester. So we're in New York State at the moment. They've gone from a small rural village called Hydesville to Rochester, which was a city, you know, about 40 miles away. And there were lots of intellectuals, lots of progressive thinkers living in Rochester at the time. And they were quite taken by and large with what the Fox sisters were doing. I think for the reason I've just mentioned, you know, there were so many new ideas, so many new scientific discoveries at the time. It perhaps today, many people will perhaps think that people who attended the Fox sisters' seances were perhaps a little gullible. But I think if you look at it in the context of the time, it's understandable why intellectuals, educated, deep thinking people would, you know, have been interested in the possibilities of what the Fox sisters were doing and would have been willing to think, you know, this could be a genuine thing which we'd like to investigate further.
Well, I've mentioned that you found a link between Kate Fox and the equal rights campaigner Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but you've also found one with, of all people, the mighty Frederick Douglass.
Yes. I mean, Frederick Douglass, I have to say, was more sceptical. He was friends with a couple, Isaac and Amy Post, who were very much more believing, and they invited him to a séance at their home, at which the Fox sisters would be performing, perhaps for want of a better word. And we know that he was much more sceptical, and actually sort of ended up leaving the séance in a bit of a huff, I suppose, because we know that because he wrote later to the hostess at the séance to apologise about his behaviour. So he was definitely a bit more sceptical. However, he did maintain a friendship with the Fox sisters. So it was obviously, there was no hard feelings, obviously, on either part.
Let us begin with the Fox girls' initial public performances. And they were pretty grueling for the women. They had to sort of suffer, you know, pat downs. They had to be strip searched by committees of women.
Yes, so it was the two older sisters, so Maggie and Leah Fox, who were involved in the early demonstrations in the city of Rochester. And so Leah was in her sort of 30s at the time. There's quite a gap between her and Maggie, and Maggie was in her mid to late teens. And yes, they appeared on stage with a number of these local progressive thinkers, and, you know, the noises of spirits were heard all around the hall. But you're right, after the actual demonstration, they were investigated by committees of men and also women. So when it was the patting down and strip searching, it was women doing the investigations. And so after every performance, they would be investigated by a committee, and the next day the committee would come back to the concert hall and, you know, tell the audience what they had discovered. There were certainly many members of the audience and many members of those committees who were extremely sceptical about what the Fox sisters were apparently doing.
At the same time, there were people in the audience who believed they were watching witches. In fact, you'd say that some brought tar to a meeting.
Yes, so I think there were various categories of people that came to these demonstrations. Some came because they believed what the Fox sisters were doing, and they wanted to witness this for themselves. And, you know, they thought there was no trickery involved. There were people who were convinced that they were pulling the wool over people's eyes, but they were just trying to expose them as frauds. But you're absolutely right. There were also people who felt that they were perhaps doing the devil's work, if you like, you know, and really felt that they were doing something morally wrong, something against the church. And yes, this could lead to threats of physical violence and, you know, quite narrow escapes sometimes.
Emily, the girls set out on a national tour, despite division in the community about whether or not they're evil. I mentioned P.T. Barnum when introducing you. Was he intrigued by them?
We don't really know that for certain. I mean, he will have been aware of what the Fox sisters were doing. They arrived in New York City at a time when he was very active himself, and they were, found themselves very much the talk of the town for a time. But any newspapers were very taken with this, and they would send reporters to the Fox sisters' seances. So there were many reports of them in the papers all the time. Once these reports started to appear, many well-known figures of the age, celebrities or well-known intellectuals, also wanted to come and see what they were doing. So they managed to generate a great deal of publicity. And I think there was a kind of you mentioned Barnum, there was a sort of showman-like or showwoman-like aspect to what they were doing.
This is Late Night Live on Radio National Summer. You're listening to a chat with Emily Mirakawa about some of the early 19th century spiritualists whose lives she documents in her book Out of the Shadows, Six Visionary Victorian Women in Search of a Public Voice, published by Counterpoint. Emily, introduces now to Emma Harding. How did she end up as a spirit medium?
Yeah, so Emma Harding's quite an interesting character. She was a British woman who was originally an actress and stage performer, and she had a sort of reasonably successful career on the West End stage in London, and this eventually took her to Broadway in New York City. Didn't really set things ablaze there, but while she was in New York City, she became quite interested in the spiritualist movement, which was in the wake of the Fox sisters, you know, was still very, very popular in New York. And Emma had apparently had a backstory of experiencing visions from an early age. She also obviously had this background in performance. She also had a background in writing articles and that sort of thing. She would talk about later. So she had various skills that I think contributed to the career that she went on to have. And so she eventually became a spirit medium. And her particular talent was what was known as trance lecturing, which would involve her appearing on a public stage, apparently in a semi-trance state, and giving speeches often on quite controversial topics. But I think in some way she managed to get around that by presenting it, or perhaps genuinely believing that she was speaking the words of dead spirits, which allowed her to take some responsibility.
Well, one of them was the very influential Benjamin Franklin. But she had the ability to hold thousands in her thrall by channeling Benjamin Franklin and his ilk.
Yes, she would give speeches to huge audiences. It's really quite remarkable the number of people that would turn out to see Emma Harding Britton giving these talks. I think for two reasons. One, because obviously it's quite novel to have someone who's apparently channeling the thoughts of dead spirits. But I think also because just having a woman up on stage speaking in public had a novelty of its own at the time. So people would come both because of the spirit side of things, but also they would come just for the spectacle of seeing a woman talking in public.
Well, the spectacle culminates in her invitation to give a eulogy for Abraham Lincoln after he died. This was also a mass event.
She had actually been approached a little earlier to give speeches in support of the re-election of Abraham Lincoln. And then after his death, she was actually asked to give the first public commemoration to the late president that was held in New York City. And really, that's an enormous thing because she was a woman, so not perhaps an obvious choice because of that. She was not even someone who'd been in the United States for very long. She'd come from Great Britain about a decade earlier. And so really it was quite something that somebody could turn up in the United States and then 10 years later be asked to give this extremely important speech that was given before a huge audience and also made into a pamphlet so that other people could buy it and read it afterwards. So it's really, I think we can see this as the pinnacle of her career.
And again, these women use their prominence, use their skills, use their theatrical abilities to push progressive causes. This is an extraordinary equation. The life of Victoria Woodhull was one of particular interest. Tell us about Victoria.
So Victoria was an American woman who, again, came from quite a humble background. And she first became well-known, you know, on a national level, really, when she set up the first brokerage firm owned by a woman, so it's her and her sister, on Wall Street. What had brought her to a position where she was able to do that was the fact that prior to that, she'd arrived in New York City and begun advising investors on how they should invest their wealth, apparently because of tips she was given by dead spirits. This ability, or whatever we want to call it, brought her to the attention of Cornelius Vanderbilt, who, of course, was one of the wealthiest men of the age. He was very impressed both by Victoria and her sister, Tennessee. In fact, many people gossiped that he was more than that with Tennessee, perhaps romantically involved with her. But anyway, yes, Victoria and her sister managed to accumulate great wealth on Wall Street. And eventually she would take that wealth and put it behind a campaign to have herself elected as the first female president of the United States.
Now, I had no idea that there was this paradox. Women could not vote, but they could still run for office.
Yes. I mean, I suppose the situation hadn't really been tested before. And obviously we know that she was not successful, for many reasons, but one of them may well have been that there were no women who were able to vote for her. Because I think she obviously did appeal to some would-be male voters, but I think she would perhaps have particularly proved inspiring to women had they had the opportunity to vote.
Well, she campaigned. She campaigned on that right to vote, also penal reform. And she starts her own newspaper to strengthen her bid for the presidency. And lo and behold, publishes the Communist Manifesto in English in 1871. What a remarkable woman.
Yes, I mean, she certainly wasn't afraid to court controversy, and we might again see it, it's quite strange that somebody who wanted to set up a brokerage firm on Wall Street and wanted to make lots of money might also feel moved to publish the Communist Manifesto. There were certainly some contradictions in Woodhull's outlook on things, but it's one of the things that makes her really fascinating. And I think even though she obviously wasn't successful, we know that from looking at history, what was striking is that for quite some time before her campaign sort of came off the rails, newspapers were taking her bid for the presidency with some seriousness. It attracted a lot of coverage. It wasn't all just people laughing at her. And so I think that's quite remarkable that she managed to achieve that, at a time when, as you say, women didn't really have the vote.
Emily, how did you feel about the women at the end of your research? Did you think that they were basically charlatans and opportunists, or were they much more significant than that?
Well, I think there's kind of a scale of belief between them. I think it's hard to argue that they were all completely genuine about what they were doing all of the time, because all of them, I would say, did get caught out lying at various points in their career. And sometimes, they would say one thing at one point and another thing at another point. So you could not really make the argument they were wholly truthful. But I think, I think there were certainly people at the time who believed that they were just complete charlatans. I think it was probably actually a little bit more complicated than that. If we take the case of Emma Harding Britton, the trans lecturer, for instance, you could say that she was using her spiritualism as an opportunity to voice thoughts on quite controversial topics. But it's also possible, I think, that she genuinely believed that these thoughts were being given to her by spirits or by unseen presences, because perhaps to admit that she herself was thinking these things and talking about them in public would have been just so beyond the pale that perhaps this was a way that her mind worked around this. So I think that's another possibility. I think another thing to say is that a lot of these women did continue their investigations just sort of privately in this area, even into old age, long after there was a financial incentive really for doing it. So I think it's quite complicated.
Victoria Woodhull goes to England and marries again. Emma Harding, I discover from you, travelled to Australia to spread the word of spiritualism.
Yes, so this was, I think, in the late 1870s. She and her husband, another spiritualist, travelled to Australia. And I think they spent about a year there. We know that Emma gave speeches in Melbourne and Sydney. And also her autobiography talks quite a bit about travelling around more rural, remote areas of Australia, trying to spread the word. I mean, again, there were people who enthusiastically believed, as there were in Britain and the United States. There were people who were more sceptical. But again, she was a very engaging public speaker, and many people, I think, were quite taken with what she was, the spectacle she was putting on, whether or not they genuinely believed she was contacting spirits.
Emily, I'm not going to tell the listener what became of the Fox sisters, because there's a great twist in your story, but their careers took a great toll on them, didn't it?
Yes, I think particularly in the case of the younger two Fox sisters. Leah was the oldest sister. She was significantly older than them. You can really think of her as the managerial presence, guiding the careers of all three. The younger two, I think, were often quite swept along with decisions that she was making about how their careers would go. And it, particularly in the case of those two, the pressure became far too much. They ended up both becoming alcoholics. They ended up becoming quite bitter, both towards Leah herself, but also the spiritualist movement as a whole at times. And as you say, that does lead to kind of an interesting twist towards the end of their careers.
As well as reading you, I read a great piece in New Yorker about a month ago, talking about the current state of spiritualism in the US, and business is still booming. It's never gone away, has it?
Yes, I read that article as well, and I found it quite interesting. And it made me think about periods in history when there have been either there has been popularity for spiritualism or there has been a resurgence. So obviously the 19th century is what we've been talking about in this interview. But I think, as you mentioned earlier, also in the aftermath of the First World War, when many, many people had lost their lives, when this huge global catastrophe had just occurred, when people were perhaps feeling quite lost about the world that they'd come back to, we saw a real surge in interest in spiritualism then. And I think you shouldn't overstate the parallels, but in the midst of a global pandemic, we've had a situation where a lot of people have felt quite isolated. A lot of people have lost loved ones. A lot of people are perhaps, you know, have been in their houses, perhaps reading things on the internet. So you can see certain parallels there between these three key historical periods.
Emily, I've got to go home and play with my Ouija board, so thank you very much for coming on. Emily Midorikawa, author of the wonderful Out of the Shadows, Six Visionary Victorian Women in Search of a Public Voice. And as you heard, they certainly found it. It's published by Counterpoint.